Good evening and welcome to this, the first televised debate in this Senate campaign. Through negotiations with the campaign offices of Mr. Humphrey and Mr. McGregor, a format agreeable to both parties has been selected. Four Mid-Minnesota newsmen will be asking questions of each candidate on an alternating basis. The candidate to whom a question is asked will be allowed 1 minute and 30 seconds for his answer, his opponent 45 seconds for additional comment, or if he so chooses, rebuttal time. Participating are former Vice President Hubert Humphrey, former Mayor of Minneapolis, the United States Senator, and unsuccessful candidate for the presidency in 1968. The Republican candidate is Minnesota's 3rd District Congressman, Clark McGregor. McGregor has served in Congress for the past 10 years. We'll be back to introduce our panelists in just a minute.
Your full service banker hopes tonight's debate will help you decide which way to vote. But perhaps more important, it will convince you that you should take full advantage of your right to vote. Whether you don't vote or don't vote, you're still going to live under one form of government or another. The thing to remember is people generally get just the kind of government they want, especially when they don't vote. It's your government. Have a say in it. Vote.
Participating in tonight's debate are four Mid-Minnesota newsmen. Let's introduce them. First of all, Fred Berry, news director, WJON Radio, St. Cloud. Les Selnow, city editor of the Brainerd Daily Dispatch. Marv Bossert, newscaster for WDAY Television in Fargo. And Bruce Nelson, political reporter for the St. Cloud Daily Times. The candidates will be allowed to make a 3-minute opening statement. By a flip of the coin, Mr. Humphrey will be the first to speak. At the close of the debate, Mr. McGregor will speak finally. Mr. Humphrey.
But we're here to discuss the most important business of people, namely the business of representative government. And government policy must be judged by how it affects people. And it's on the basis of that standard that I ask you to judge the policies of the Republican administration and the record of my opponent. Now, first, let's take a look at this economy of ours. Is it healthy and is it growing? What are the facts? Not what is the political rhetoric? Well, I think the first fact is that the cost of living is at an all-time high, and it continues to grow at an annual rate of a little over 6%, eroding our savings and chewing up our income. Secondly, unemployment continues to rise. It's now over 5%, and the prediction is that by next summer it will be over 6%. 1.5 million more people are out of work today than were 20 months ago, and another million by next year. Interest rates are the highest in 100 years. There's tight money and high interest, which makes credit very costly. Our economy is at a standstill, and it is estimated that we're losing $1 billion per week in lost production and work, which results in billions of dollars of lost revenue needed for vital programs for federal, state, and local government. Housing construction is the lowest that it's been in 10 years, and young couples that want to buy a house can't seem to afford it if they can get mortgage money. And the elderly are being denied the housing that they need. With our schools in difficulty, with property tax the highest that they've been in years, they're at 53% increase the last 3 years here in Minnesota. We've had an administration that's vetoed 2 federal aid to education bills that would have helped Minnesota education. And my opponent voted to sustain one veto and reversed himself, then voted to override the other. At a time when we need to expand our battle against disease, to provide more hospital beds for civilians and for veterans, and to do something about rehabilitation for our crippled, the Republican administration vetoes a bill, crippling medical schools and slowing down medical research. My opponent voted to sustain that veto, and in doing so, he voted against funds for the expansion of the Wilmar State Rice Memorial Hospital, Moorhead St. Ansgar Hospital, Benson Hospital, the Alexandria Douglas County Hospital, the Wadena Memorial Hospital. That veto cost Minnesota $11,275,000. And rural Minnesota hasn't escaped the crippling effects of these Republican policies either. In the month of August, we had the sharpest decline in farm prices in 22 years. The parity ratio is the lowest it's been since 1933. And the Republican administration seeks to pass through the Congress, insisting upon it, a farm bill which is repudiated by 24 farm organizations. I think we can judge an administration by what it does to people, and what it's doing is not good.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. And now an introductory statement from Congressman Clark McGregor.
Thank you very much, Bob and Mr. Humphrey and gentlemen of the panel.
ladies and gentlemen, one of the great strengths of Minnesota is the political diversity of opinion by the people of Minnesota. One of the great strengths of representative government occurs when diversity of opinion is reflected in the legislature. You know, that's true in the United States House of Representatives, where Minnesota has 5 Republicans and 3 DFLers. It's reflected in the state legislature, where the people of Minnesota prefer to elect a majority of conservatives over liberals. The only place that representative government is denied the opportunity to work for Minnesota as it should is in the United States Senate. We've had a left-to-center monopoly of opinion in the Senate for 12 long years. It's time to change that this year. I'll tell you the thing that strikes me as very important in this Senate campaign, and that is that Minnesota be making a serious mistake to return to the United States Senate a man whose judgment has been very bad on the record. First, of course, they'd be perpetuating a monopoly of ultra-liberal philosophy and ultra-liberal policy in the United States Senate. But more often than that, my opponent has shown that his language has been loose and his judgment has been bad on critical issues, war and peace, justice, law and order, and on the very important question of inflation, spending and taxes. But let me tell you 2 illustrations that disturb me more than anything else. My opponent doesn't have conviction. My opponent is just as ready to change his opinion when the political opinion polls show that that would be the politically expedient thing to do. And he's quickly to follow the dictates of a party leader or party boss. Let me give you 2 examples. In 1962, when everyone was worried about the introduction of Russian missiles into Cuba, I was too. I was a congressman. I introduced a resolution calling for a quarantine. Mr. Kennedy adopted the course I recommended. Mr. Humphrey called me a cornfield general for recommending the course that Mr. Kennedy followed, and he praised Mr. Kennedy lavishly for following my recommendation. Let me tell you about a bill for tax credits for the parents of middle America sending youngsters to college. Mr. Humphrey authored that bill in 1963. I've authored it too. It had broad bipartisan support. But in February of 1964, LBJ was opposed to it. Mr. Humphrey turned 180 degrees, he voted against his own bill, and he got enough senators to go along and reverse their course so as to defeat the proposal. Now that's the sort of old politics I'm talking about. That's the sort of political expediency we've got to replace in Minnesota. When Mr. Johnson was president, Hubert Humphrey was a hawk in Vietnam, thought it was our great adventure. Now he supports or agrees in principle with his party's program for immediate and unconditional withdrawal. He has taken the same duplicitous positions on justice, law, and order, and on inflation. You and I are paying $3 million in taxes today just to pay the interest on the added debt that was accumulated during the last 8 years that he was in power in Washington.
Thank you, Mr. McGregor. Now our panel of newsmen, placing the first question, Fred Berry, News Director, WJON.
Mr. Humphrey, the Pentagon this morning released information that Russia is thought to be establishing a submarine base in Cuba. Should this be true, and should the Russian submarines be armed with nuclear weapons, would you favor any type of confrontation such as we all remember during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, I'm not going to advise the President on a matter as delicate as that, and I wouldn't be even introducing a resolution about it. I think that the President of the United States must take a good look at what the facts are. We don't have the facts yet. We have some facts. We have some information. I don't think that the President of the United States wants me to be commenting upon what is a most likely and could be a very serious matter of national security from out here in Alexandria, Minnesota. I have faith that the President of the United States will protect the security of this country. If I go to the Senate, I hope to help him do just that.
Now, a comment from Congressman Clark McGregor.
I have always felt that a constructive resolution showed proper leadership when drafted and introduced by a member of Congress. I thought so in 1962, I think so in 1970, and if elected to the Senate, I will continue to put into resolution form ideas as to how America might deal with its problems, whether those ideas lead to executive department action or action by the Congress. With respect to the news today or yesterday about the Russian submarines in Cuba, I think we're seeing an increase in degree of Russian involvement rather than a difference in kind. They've been operating those submarines for some time. Surely this is a situation that should be watched very carefully, and a situation where everyone in government or who aspires to be in government ought to offer constructive ideas.
Thank you, Mr. McGregor. Our next panelist, Mr. Les Salnow, Brainerd Daily Dispatch.
Mr. McGregor, in Brainerd, as in most cities, I'm sure across Minnesota, property owners are complaining that local taxes are becoming just a heavier and heavier burden. In many of our school districts, taxes have doubled in the past 5 years, for example. Do you believe that the federal government can and should relieve the property owner of some of this burden? If so, how should this be done and still not lose local control?
Well, that's the best way always to deal with our federal income tax code so as to address a problem from Washington but retain local control is through the avenue of tax credits. This is a time-tested method by which we seek to deal with problems in Washington without running the show from the bureaucracy there. I think serious consideration must be given, just as soon as the Federal Treasury is in a position to sustain this, to the idea of giving, particularly to older people, a partial credit against federal income taxes for the real estate taxes that they have to pay. In other words, when they have put their youngsters through school, when they have to deal with the high cost of property taxes, it seems to me they ought to get some relief from the federal government on income taxes. Now, that doesn't do the whole problem, because you've got some people, elderly people who own their own homes, who don't pay any federal income taxes, but at least this is an approach that I will study very carefully if I'm privileged to be elected to the Senate. This idea of tax credits is a great way to approach the problem. You know, we give people a deduction from their gross income before figuring their federal income taxes for the interest on a home mortgage. This encourages people to be homeowners. We ought to keep people in their homes if we possibly can by giving the relief I've suggested to burden some local property taxes.
Thank you, Mr. McGregor. Mr. Humphrey?
First of all, I'd make it quite clear that 75% of the older people in this country do not have sufficient income to pay federal taxes. That's number one. Secondly, I would suggest that the property taxes are so high at the present time that the relief that they need is a large injection of federal aid to education. And every educator in the country, with few exceptions, says that's what is needed. And not vetoes, not less, but more. And may I just respond a moment to the tax credit? When I introduced my bill for tax credit, there was no federal aid to education. The choice was between tax credits, which some would get, and federal aid to education, which would help the poor and the middle income and the upper income together. Now, I voted for the federal aid to education bill. My opponent did not, and he has not supported educational measures.
Well, the next question is Marv Bossert from WDAY-TV.
Mr. Humphrey, along this same line, as long as we're on it, do you favor a guaranteed income for the poor?
I favor the, a form of guaranteed income, income maintenance. I think that President Nixon's proposal that he has presented is very meritorious. I doubt that it goes far enough, but I think it is a very good beginning. And if I'm permitted to go to the United States Senate, I hope to be able to support constructive efforts like that. You see, I don't intend to go to the Senate as a man that just tries to pick on presidents. I intend to go there to pick and choose. When I think he's doing well, he'll have my support. When I disagree with him, he'll have my opposition. I happen to believe that our present welfare system is an anachronism, and in many ways, it's an insult to the people. We need a welfare system, a program of income maintenance for people that cannot work, that in a family situation must take care of their family. But we also need a program of work and of work training to put people who are capable of employment back on the job. But in order to do that, Marv, you've got to have an economy that's growing. You can train people for jobs today, but there are no jobs. There are young people today graduating from college, as they did last spring, with no jobs. And if you're going to have a work program as well as a humanitarian welfare program, you have to have an expanding economy that makes it possible for those who you want to have work, who you train for work, to be able to go into work. The people that have been laid off recently are the very people who were trained under other programs. They were the last hired, and now they're the first fired. I say that's a cruel way of doing business.
Quick response, Congressman McGregor.
Well, we've gone somewhat afield from your question. Your question again?
The question was, do you favor a guaranteed annual income for the poor?
I voted for the very comprehensive, very exciting family assistance program, which is a welfare reform program. It passed the House of Representatives last year. I'm pleased to say that this initiative of the Republican administration, an initiative which was totally lacking in the preceding administration, received bipartisan support in the House of Representatives. I have looked with some sadness at the United States Senate to see the tired old men of Hubert Humphrey's party who run the show in the United States Senate drag their feet on the consideration of this very comprehensive, very exciting program which will deal with the working poor. It'll keep them working but enable them to supplement their income with federal assistance. This is a workfare program, not really a welfare program.
We'll continue our debate in just one moment.
This evening, you're present while two capable men who seek your vote expound their...
Mr. Humphrey and Mr. McGregor. A question from Bruce Nelson, St. Cloud Daily Times.
Congressman, you and your opponent quarreled earlier this week over your respective backgrounds on farm legislation. Mr. Humphrey attacked your farm voting record, and you in turn claimed that farmers suffered major setbacks during the Johnson-Humphrey administration. Now, irregardless of past performances, Congress will in the next session be faced with legislation extending collective bargaining rights to farmers. Where do you stand on that issue, Congressman?
I do not favor congressional action to deal with this question. I think that it's possible for groups that believe very strongly in organization to organize under existing laws. I think that the NFO has done an excellent job of bringing the message to farmers that the opportunities are there to permit them to deal collectively with their respective individual problems, just as is provided with other elements of the farm economy. But you referred to these criticisms and about background in farming. I think that your listeners should know that my grandfather came from Scotland and was farming in central Minnesota three generations ago. I've got my roots deep in the soil in Minnesota. And for somebody to suggest that I have voted against the Minnesota farmers is ridiculous. The truth of the matter is that I have voted in a very similar pattern with Minnesota's four farm congressmen, Odin Langan, John Zwack, Anker Nelson, and Al Quie. I think that my farm record has been good, and I think my opponent does too. I've cast over 100 votes on agriculture legislation that directly or indirectly affect Minnesota agriculture and agribusiness. He picked out five and he criticized them. It must be that 95 he agrees with. 95 used to be a passing grade, and I'm surprised that the professor doesn't give me an A.
With comment, Mr. Humphrey.
Well, the reason the professor doesn't give you an A, Congressman, is because you missed the important questions and you got on the trivia. In 1961, you voted against the Emergency Feed Grain Act. You voted against the Agricultural Act of 1961. You voted against the Feed Grains Act of 1963, the meat import quotas of 1964. You voted to recommit the Agricultural Act of 1965, and recommit is a nice word to kill. And then you reversed yourself with the other Republican congressman and decided to vote for it. I have to tell you also, Mr. Congressman, that in those dark years of the 50s of the Republican administration, Minnesota farm income went down from $531 million to $462 million net income. It went up after 1961 from $462 million up to $676 million.
Mr. Humphrey, I have a question I'd like to ask you. The Nixon administration has urged college administrators, those who run college campuses, to take a firmer hand in dealing with unrest on the college campuses. Would you comment on that?
Well, I think that there has to be a firmer hand in dealing with unrest, not only on college campuses, but lawlessness and crime and disorder throughout our country. Now, having urged the administrators of college campuses to take a firmer stand, that doesn't necessarily end the problem. Our universities today are bulging at the seams. 10 years ago, we had 3 million people in our universities, students. Today, we have over 7 million. That problem within itself poses a major, serious problem to the administrators and the teachers of universities. I would hope that we would look upon our universities with some sense of perspective. There are some militants. There are some people who seek to destroy. There are those that that commit acts of disorder and violence. But 95% of the students at universities today are working hard or harder than any student body in the history of this country. The students at our universities, many of them are actively engaged in volunteer operations. Thousands of them, indeed. Speaking of our own University of Minnesota, I think that Dr. Malcolm Moose has done one of the finest jobs of administrating a university of any university president in the United States. And he's to be commended. We've had a modest amount, a very little amount, of campus violence here in the state of Minnesota. But I do suggest that university administrators, in consultation with faculty, take a stand against those who disrupt classes, who in any way seek to destroy the academic standing of a university, who seek to use violence and disorder as a remedy for what they consider to be the lack of proper university curriculum.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. McGregor?
Bob, I'd like to see all colleges and universities adopt the sort of plan that's known as the Father Hesperger Notre Dame plan. That is, have every matriculating freshman be made aware of the rules of conduct and discipline on the campus, and when there's a takeover of a building or a denial of the rights of the great majority of the students by the radical few, to give them a period of time to straighten up and fly right. And if they don't do it, then the ultimate penalty, of course, is expulsion. I think this is a sound program. I don't believe that the federal government ought to be dictating codes of disciplinary conduct on the campus. But I do think that those in public office should not also be encouraging, by their loose talk, the resort to violence or revolution as a way to effect social change or to deal with problems. My opponent has done exactly that. I won't do that. I haven't, and I won't in the Senate.
We'll return in just a moment. Your full service. By previous agreement, this portion of the program has been reserved for closing comments from both candidates. May we hear first from Mr. Humphrey.
Well, I've said in the beginning that we should judge by the facts and not by the rhetoric, and I think I shall maintain that position. Now, my opponent has seen fit to indicate that I would incite to violence and to revolution, indicating a lack of attention and concern about law and order. I would say to this that first I served as mayor of a great city, and I gave my city law and order as the mayor, where you are really tested. I was the author of the first important anti-narcotics drug bill in the 1950s and 60s, known as the Durham-Humphrey Act.